For as long as there has been oppression, enforced humility has been one of the tools of the oppressors. Humility is an incredibly efficient value for oppressors to pretend to practice and to encourage or force on those whom they oppress. So it is no surprise at all, that humility was one of the Christian values foisted on the African slaves by those who enslaved them in this country. Be humble, the preachers taught the slaves. Avoid pride. Embrace modesty. Be like Jesus, they preached, meaning the meek Jesus, who with quiet humility took all of the abuse heaped on him. Think Mel Gibson's Jesus in the Passion of the Christ, if you want a picture of it. Not the Jesus who overturned the money changers' tables, or who at great risk stood up for the downtrodden. These teachings about humility reinforced in slaves that it was okay to be low in rank, importance, and status. After all, Jesus was. These teachings also reinforced an internal feeling of insignificance, inferiority, and subservience. Slave owners counted on these lessons, along with the lash, to maintain the status quo of slavery. After abolition, the oppressors used the same lessons of humility to reinforce acquiescence to the Jim Crow laws and customs. They used humility to extend the oppression for another 100 years. The African-American poet Langston Hughes, in his poem Warning, which I think came probably mid-20th century, he captures in that poem in stark and vivid simplicity what might happen when African-Americans threw off the chains of this enforced humility. Langston Hughes wrote, "Negroes, sweet and docile, meek, humble and kind, beware the day they change their mind. Wind in the cotton fields, gentle breeze, beware the hour it uproots trees." And nothing frightened the slave owners or the enforcers of Jim Crow segregation more than this. And they were right to fear a rejection of this oppressive virtue of humility. It did uproot the trees of slavery and state-sanctioned segregation, freed slaves, did so much to help the Union win the Civil War, and of course African Americans led the efforts in the 1950s and 60s to end Jim Crow. Humility has also been a tool of the oppression of sexism and patriarchy. White male theologians in the 1950s, for example, talked incessantly about pride as the worst sin of all. They lifted up humility and selflessness as virtues that all people should embrace in the face of this monstrous evil of pride. Maybe this made sense for men of privilege, who after all had the power, but pride is the number one sin made no sense for those who were denied power and agency in their lives, including women. The theologian Valerie Sabine compellingly made this point in an article in the Journal of Religion published in 1960. She called this article "The Human Situation, a Feminine View," and she asserted that underdevelop or the negation of self was the biggest dilemma faced by women, not pride. Women asserting themselves as individuals, not selflessness, was Sabine's prescription for women oppressed by sexism and patriarchy. Many feminists today point back to her brilliant article as the genesis of feminist theology. So all this is to suggest that we have to be really careful when we think about humility. I find it interesting that the first definition of humble in my dictionary is not proud or arrogant, modest. And the second definition is having a feeling of insignificance, inferiority, subservience. As Valerie Sabine pointed out more than 50 years ago, the first definition is problematic when it confirms the second definition in a person. And so to me, we can avoid the pitfalls about humility if we recognize that there is a balance between pride and humility. People who have found this balance embrace their inherent goodness. They understand that they have unique and amazing gifts to offer the world. I would call this understanding genuine pride or self-esteem. This genuine pride to me is absolutely a prerequisite to being a spiritually healthy and whole person. At the same time, people who found balance between humility and pride also understand that they are not perfect. They understand that they will make mistakes, sometimes egregious mistakes. They understand that they have limitations. And they understand that the blessings in their lives come not just from their inherent goodness and their gifts and skills, but also from the amazing gifts of other people, of society, and sometimes plain old good luck or grace or whatever we want to call it. And they understand in the words that Leah shared in the poem that there fundamentally is nothing in the universe lower than they are. We're all tied together. We're all in this together. Nothing is lower than anything else. Nobody is lower. I would call this understanding genuine humility. So genuine pride and genuine humility complement each other. Having one without the other is trouble. So is the significant imbalance between the two. So what we should do, I think, is focus on what to develop, which end. What we need to do depends on where we are in a given moment on the spectrum. Pride, not balanced by humility, is arrogance and hubris at its worst. It is narcissism. This is why it made sense to see pride and hubris as significant sins for the slave owner or for the prosperous white male in the 1950s. Genuine humility would have actually been a pretty good virtue for these folks to cultivate. Genuine humility might have helped them gain a self-understanding about the abundant privileges that society afforded them. It might have helped them stop trying to coerce and control and oppress other people. On the other end of the spectrum, humility not balanced by pride is self-negation and subservience and can even cultivate a sense of shame. This is why humility, when it's interpreted as self-negation, was such a destructive value for slaves or for women oppressed by patriarchy. Rather than being destructive, self-pride was actually a key to breaking out of the shackles of oppression. It is really important, then, to have a clear-eyed view of where we are on this pride-humility spectrum. This tells us whether developing self-pride on the one hand or humility on the other hand is our more important spiritual task at the moment. The spiritual goal, again, is to bring both ends of the spectrum into balance, to have, in other words, both genuine pride and genuine humility. And at the service yesterday, one person shared a great suggestion for how to do this work. She suggested using this idea of interdependence, which we as Unitarian Universalists affirm, to help bring balance. If we find that we're too much on the pride end, it can help us to remember that we're all in this together, that we're tied together, it's not all us. And if we're too much on the humility end, well, it's always helpful to remember that we're not alone, that hopefully there are people we can reach out to. For me, an image of the self-assessment is to look at a mirror, kind of a special mirror that shows not just what's on the outside, but also what's on the inside of us. If you look at that mirror and you're disappointed or even disgusted, then your spiritual task on the spectrum is to work on developing your pride. If, on the other hand, you look at the mirror and you see God's gift to the universe, then you've got some work to do on the humility end. So at the risk of erring on the side of narcissism, I am going to offer myself as a minister as an example of the self-examination that can happen regarding this humility-pride spectrum. And I want to say up front, as I've said before, for me, minister is a role. It's not the whole of my being. I have actually a couple other roles that I think are more important to me, husband and father, namely. But nonetheless, being a minister for quite a while now has been really important to me. So contemplating where Roger as minister is on this pride-humility spectrum starts with an honest self-assessment. I think I have some gifts for ministry, and I've tried to maximize these gifts by studying and working hard. It's important for each of us to understand and appreciate the gifts we have, to feel pride in them, and I do. I also understand I have some deficits, and I've tried to work on some of those, and some I've just decided to try to work around. In cultivating my role as minister, I also find it incredibly valuable to be mindful of all the gifts from beyond myself that have helped me in this work. I don't have an exhaustive list to share today, but here are some high points of what's helped me. First of all, my upbringing in a vibrant, liberal church, ably served by three wonderful ministers who had incredibly diverse skills. My parents' unwavering blessing in my wanting to be a minister. My professors in college and divinity school. My internship supervisor and the people in the pews at that church. Numerous ministerial colleagues who have mentored and inspired me over the years, including right here in this building, Dottie Matthews and Jason Seymour and Leah Hart Landsberg and Karen Sandberg. The blessing of being called by a visionary, dedicated congregation over 22 years ago, you, the support and encouragement of my wife and kids, and more than my fair share of plain old good luck. The success I have enjoyed here as a minister really does humble me because I am but a small part of it. As Leah mentioned in her call to gather, the spiritual exercise this month in our journey groups is to identify one way this month to be uniquely humble. So I know exactly what I'm going to do for my spiritual exercise this month. I'm going to write a thank you note to my internship minister, and this is Ted Anderson, who is the minister at the Second Congregational Meeting House Society, Unitarian Universalist, in Nantucket, Massachusetts. Yes, a longer name than ours. I have to tell you, I'm really lousy at keeping up with people, and I've been really lousy at keeping up with him. I don't think I've written him a peep in 15 years or more. And the truth is, he was an amazing supervisor. He gave generously of himself to my development as a minister. I learned from him not only a lot about preaching and teaching and leading a church, I also learned about seeing my ministry as something that goes beyond the walls of the congregation. He had a highly visible and important and substantive role in Nantucket. Having ministered in an era in which too many Unitarian Universalist ministers failed to enforce healthy interpersonal boundaries, he unswervingly abided by them. An amazing, even locally legendary sense of humor leavened his ministry. He was always approachable. He taught me how to be a minister in a small congregation, something I needed to learn because I grew up in a large congregation. And he wore really wild ties, or as one possibly appreciative congregant put it, sincere ties. My ministry is a daily tribute to the many things that he taught me through his teaching, and probably even more through his example. And I wouldn't be half the minister I am today without him. I often think of him with gratitude, and actually telling him that would be a really good idea, a really good spiritual exercise. I'm mindful, too, that I wrote about this week, and then I realized yesterday that this weekend is the 25th anniversary of the beginning of my internship. So, tomorrow, you can hold me to this. I'm going to write a letter, and it's going to be good for him, I think, to get, but even better for me to write. It is a good exercise in humility. Gratitude and humility go hand in hand. So you may notice in my reflections on my ministry that I am kind of working on the humility end of this pride-humility spectrum. And this is the conscious result of looking at myself as a minister in the mirror. There are a lot of indicators of a successful ministry here, starting with the fact we've grown from 100 to 650 plus. I'm aware of this, but I also understand I'm going to really get in trouble if I start thinking this is all the result of my skills and efforts and personality. It's just not true. and it would lead me to arrogance and hubris. I'm also aware that arrogance and hubris seem to be an occupational hazard with senior ministers of large congregations. So I have concluded that I need to focus on the humility end of the spectrum. Another reason I want to focus on humility in my ministry comes from my understanding that building bridges between people who are different from me takes humility. And that's true both within these walls and beyond these walls. Humility is essential to bridge building. So actually is pride. When approaching someone different from you, different in terms of gender, race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, class, age, whatever, spirituality, it's important to have an understanding of who you are and of your own culture. One of the things that has really sabotaged interactions between white people and people from historically marginalized groups in our own culture is the persistent failure of whites to understand that we who are white actually have a culture. When we fail to recognize this fact, then too often we unconsciously assume that our culture is everybody's culture. This is the default culture. We fail to recognize then that there's fundamental differences between cultures. It also doesn't help for whites to think that anything non-white is inherently superior to anything white. In the same way, it doesn't help to think everything non-white is inferior. When we interact with folks who are different from ourselves, we need metaphorically to take off our shoes because we are on holy ground. Their ground, our ground, the ground we share. Finding a balance between pride and humility is really important in the work of bridge building. And I want to briefly explore this humility-pride spectrum in two other ways. First, where is Unitarian Universalism in this spectrum? I would say, by and large, we're a little too much on the pride end of things. I see this in our smug and arrogant assumption that we are just a little bit, okay, maybe a lot smarter than other people. If people would just use their brains, they would be Unitarian Universalists. We're the place where you don't have to check your brain at the door. I've heard these things said. I've thought these things. This suggests to me that Unitarian Universalism and this individual Unitarian Universalist have some work to do on the humility end of things. And finally, let's apply this spectrum to this election, which mercifully will have taken place before we meet again. There is a lot wrong with our election process, beginning with all the money that's flooding this process. But I would suggest that another problem on all sides is an imbalance in this pride-humility spectrum. These days, most of us, me included, don't just disagree with the conclusions when they're different from our own, but we find that the people who voice them are idiotic, lazy and entitled if you come from the right perspective, selfish if you come from the left perspective, even immoral. I think that most of us could do some work cultivating humility when it comes to elections. And this work to me is actually a prerequisite to having greater civility in our public discourse and elections. So, I have homework for you this month if you choose to accept it. Think about where you are right now in this pride-humility spectrum. Given where you are, what is it that you need to work on? And how might you work on it?